Blog Talk Radio.
Clap your hands for Angela.
Welcome to Show Talk with Angela Butler. The guest for this show is author and civil rights activist, Ms. Geraldine Edwards Hollis. Ms. Hollis is one of the Tupelo Nine from Jackson, Mississippi. I hope I pronounced it right. How are you doing, Ms. Hollis? Hello? Ms. Hollis? Hello? Ms. Hollis, are you on the line? I can't hear you, Ms. Hollis. I see your phone number, but I can't hear you.
Hello.
Ms. Hollis? Hi. Okay.
Yes. Hello?
As I was saying, hello, Ms. Hollis. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. Yes, I'm here, Ms. Hollis. Ms.
Okay.
Hollis? Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am, I can. Now, I just introduced you to the guest, to the people listening. You is the interview for tonight. So, hello, Ms. Geraldine Edward Hollis. How are you?
I'm fine, Ms. Angela Butler. Thank you for having me on your show tonight.
Yes, ma'am. And just call me Angela.
Okay.
I apologize for the mix-up earlier. The Tupelo Nine. Could you explain who the Tupelo Nine are?
Yes. The Tupelo Nine are the nine young from Tupelo College, a small college in Tupelo, Mississippi, just outside of Jackson, Mississippi. During the 1960s, in fact, this time was 1961, March the 27th, and at that time, we became known, the Tupelo Nine, because there were nine of us who participated in the well-known read-in at the white-only library there in Jackson, Mississippi.
Okay, so it was white-only. It wasn't even one way in for black and one way in for white. It was completely white-only.
Yes, it was white-only. There was another library that was dedicated to the colored, as was we would call at that time, and it was the colored only, and this library did not have the references or the books that we knew that we needed once we made our plans. So we left the colored library, and we made our way to the white-only library, which was in downtown Jackson, Mississippi.
Yes. Now, what you and the other eight did, was very dangerous, especially for that time period. You're very courageous of you.
It was very dangerous, but, you know, at that time, it was a time of change. The 60s was a time for change. And we knew that there were things going on in other parts of the country. We had heard about the Memphis, Tennessee sit-ins. We heard about some of the activities that were going on in other areas. And at Tupelo, we were proactive even at that time. What we did was get together, which was really started by the sociology forums in the sociology lab, and with some of the advisors, well, the advisor, one of the advisors from Trugill College, which was Dr. Mangrum or John Mangrum at that time, and we made a plan of what we were going to do. My book, March Memories, tells a lot about what it took to make those plans. It was not something that we just did off of the off of a whim. We really had to sit down and consider all of the circumstances, and especially those things that would cause us to lose our life, to lose our college credits, or to put our families in jeopardy. It was something that we knew that was going to be very dangerous.
Yes.
But yet we understood that this was something that was needed to be done, especially in Jackson, Mississippi, which was the capital of Mississippi.
Okay. Oh, I have family in Mississippi. I do. Near where you at? I also know a lady that was I interviewed on my show. Her name is Shaletti Ross. She's been on my show. So what happened after you tried to integrate the Jackson, Mississippi, whites only, at that time, whites only public library?
Well, like I said earlier, we went to the colored library first, and then we went to the white library. And it was something very eerie about that because you didn't see any black people in the library, and you wouldn't have, because they were only allowed if they were a janitor or someone working in the library, perhaps even out of sight. So for us to go into the library full force with 9 black youngsters, young adults, that was something that really got the eyes of all of the patrons and the attendants and administrators in that particular building. We did not just go in there. We went in there full force, knowing where we were going to go, the books that we were going to choose. Books were something that we were very dedicated about, and we all made a list of the kinds of books that we knew that would not be in the colored-only library and would give us the perfect excuse to go into the white library, because we were on a mission to search for something that we knew that we could get perhaps only there. And that's
yes.
what we did.
So why did you write the book March Memories and also the book Back to Mississippi?
Over the years, I reflect on time and think about time, what is happening and why. A lot of young people had the enthusiasm right after the early 60s when the civil rights went through. But as the 70s grew in and people became more comfortable with themselves, oh, we're free now. We can do anything we want to do. Oh, we're free now. We can just act any kind of way that we want to act. And it went on through the 80s and the 90s, and I saw a lot of our young people losing the pride that we all knew that we had as black people. And they were not knowledgeable of where we were coming from. I said to myself, there is something wrong here. People just do not understand how we got to the place where we are. And I heard a young person say, haven't it always been this way? Haven't we always been able to do what we want to do and go where we want to go? Hasn't it always been this way that we could mix and go to school together? And it just went off in my head. Somebody needs to tell the story. I'm
yes.
sure that there were many other authors out there who has told the story. But in the community where I lived, I reflected on my journals and my documentations that I've made over the years, and I started writing Back to Mississippi. This was a journal at first, because I made my first journal in the year of 1962 when I did my student teaching in the Delta of Mississippi. And that was an eye-opener also. I documented what I saw there and how people were living and how they had to work, how they had to go into the cotton fields and use a split school district, school time, where the whites went to school all year and the blacks had to stop school and go into the fields to pick the cotton. So that's when I started with my documentation, writing down what I saw in that particular town. Back in 2009 when I began to look over some of the other things that I had reflected on. And I made a note of the things that I wanted to let my granddaughter and my grandchildren know. And it was from there that I started seriously putting these things into words. It was in 2010 that I started seriously writing my book, Back to Mississippi. And it was so much of an emotional journey for me to relive those things that I felt, those things that I did, those things that I was involved in. At the end of December, I declared that I had finished my book. I sent in for my copyright and sent my manuscript to my young lady who was going to edit it. And she sent it back to me, not literally, but figuratively. She says, now, this is the story. This is all about the facts. But I need you to tell me the real story. Tell me how you felt. Tell me what you did during those days. Tell me how you shed tears. Tell me about your fears. Tell me about how you were comfortable doing some things. Just give me those kinds of things. That's what I want to hear. And so I embarked upon writing with her and rewriting those things. And on my birthday of that year, 2011, I launched my book signing for my first book, Back to Mississippi.
Okay. All right. So what was
Mark,
like I'm sorry.
Okay. I'll tell you what it was like growing up. I had a wonderful
segregation
family.
I had a wonderful family.
But segregation is something that it was a way of life. It didn't mean that we loved it or that we really understood it, but it was a way of life. People lived in certain neighborhoods. They knew that they could only go into certain places. We knew that we could not go into some of the places that most people take for granted today. I told someone, I guess maybe one of my talks about last year, and I said, how would you feel if you went into one of the fast food places now, and they tell you that you could only order from the side window, like the drive-up window, and you couldn't come inside and order, nor could you sit down inside and eat. That was the way it was. Places that would have food would let you go to the back door and pay for your food, and you would wait until all of the white patrons had their food, and then perhaps you would get yours, maybe half an hour later. So that was second-class citizenship. That was degradation. And going to school, it was really a feeling of joy when we thought that we were going to get new textbooks, only to open the books up and see that they had been written in all the way through. The name places where you put your name in the textbooks at that time were all taken up. That meant that the books were at least 5 to 6 years old when we got those books. But it did not put a damper on the education that we got. I do believe and I know that the teachers during that time were some of the most dedicated teachers ever. They took education at heart. They didn't tell you, I have it for myself and it's up to you to get it. They made sure that you understood that you needed an education in order to be able to live your best life. And they gave us things that were not in the textbooks. They made other standards that mean that we were able to reach higher in our levels of learning because they expected us to learn. And they had high expectations for us. They didn't just move us from year to year because of our ages. They moved us because of what we knew and what we had learned. So we had some of the best teachers that I can say that I've known for a long time. Education in the South and in the town where I lived was very important.
Yes, I understand that. So you were talking about growing up in Mississippi and the segregation there. When you and the others decided to have this sit-in, were you met with violence? I've read the book, but the audience may not have, people listening. Were you met with any violence, any resistance?
There was not resistance in the library. There was the detectives and police who came to arrest us. And that's one of the things. We were arrested, yes. We were told that we were not in compliance, and we knew it. And they arrested us. They didn't handcuff us, but they had us to go out of the library. Some of us went with one detective, and some of us was with two detectives. But they made sure that we would not escape them. And we had no desire to escape them. We wanted to go through the full measure to let them know that we were serious about what we were doing. At any rate, Angela, we were arrested and we were put in jail.
I understand. You were put in jail. Back then, did you get one phone call? I mean, in this day and age, when you put in jail, you get a phone call. Did any of your parents know you were there, your aunts, your grandmother, granddad, your uncle? Did anybody know you were there?
No. No, they did not know personally that we were there. They did not know exactly what we were going to do. But we did have a chance in our training to talk to our parents and let them know that we were planning something that would be something really big, but for them not to worry because we would be okay. The main thing that made a difference was that our advisors and those who supported us, which was Megar Evers, he was our major advisor, and he and others contacted the national media. So we had national coverage for this sit-in. It was one of the reasons why everything went so well, I do believe. And I say so well because this was one of the activities that did not have a lot of violence at the onset.
Okay.
When we came out of the library, the media was out there taking pictures, and there was people all around documenting that this was indeed an invasion into their territory. One of the reasons why I do believe that this was so successful is because during that time period, you had what was known as the Sovereignty Commission. And
Yes,
that was akin to the FBI or something that was doing things in covert type of a way, scaring people or threatening people so that they would go in and snitch and tell on things that was being planned. So at Tougaloo, we were such a well-known campus. And it was a private school, so we didn't have a lot of people coming on campus that would snitch on what we were doing. Everybody that came to Tougaloo came there for the same reason, to learn and to know and to be a part of something bigger than the outside community. many, many, many people who were activists at that time came to the gates of Tougaloo. And when they came onto the campus of Tougaloo, they felt safe. They felt as though they could talk, and they did. And when they talked, we listened. We listened to them talk about how we can prepare ourselves to be a better citizen, how we could prepare ourselves to be a better business person, and how we could regain our civil rights. And that's what we listened to, and that's what we talked about in those forums that we had in sociology. Tougaloo was a college that even today has such a wonderful reputation of seeking excellence and preserving excellence. And this is what made our activity so important. It was the first successful city in the state of Mississippi.
Yes, ma'am. You said something earlier about the young people. I'm 44. It seems like, well, I'm in the South. I'm near Dothan, Alabama, like 30 minutes from Dothan, Alabama. I'm on
Central
Standard Time, like you are. Even when I was in high school in the 80s, there were things going on then that didn't. It seems like after the 70s, everything went okay for a while. Then the 80s started, and it was just a different way they started to discriminate. Like
right.
Drug laws. That's one thing. And then with the fraud laws and all these different laws and things. And then, you know, they had all these little traps set in place already by the 80s. And segregation, I believe,
right.
outlawed in 1968. Am I right?
Yes.
Yeah, 1968. So they were already.
Yes, the civil rights bill was passed in 1964.
Okay, 1964, okay. So
that,
what I'm saying, ma'am.
Yes.
No, go ahead.
Hello? Yeah, I'm just saying that that was the Voting Act and all of these things that was put in place. And so many things that was put in place in the 60s, 64, 65, and 68. And people got comfortable. They felt as though, okay, we don't have to fight anymore. We don't have to challenge ourselves anymore. So people started just living life and enjoying life. And I told my granddaughter, it's like the grasshopper and the ant syndrome. People just started mm-hmm. playing and doing some things. They forgot about the fact that to earn these rights, you had to really, somebody had to do some things. And you can't just stop voting. You can't just stop participating in those things that will keep the desire to be a better person up. And I think that this was also fueled by those things that were put in place by society also, because you had an influx of, if you said that you were 42, you know that there was a crack cocaine. There were
yes,
other things.
I'm 44.
That came into play. And you had the crack babies. You had so many things that was going on. They've changed
yes.
the laws of education so that they call it social promotion. And that's why I mentioned earlier that when we went to school, you had to learn what you had to learn. You didn't just pass because you were a certain age. So they started social promotion. They wanted to get the young people out of high school. But what did it do? It didn't give them a chance to earn an education or to go to college.
Yeah.
All of those young people who were socially promoted, they fell into the arms of the prison system. And
the prison system, yes, ma'am.
We
and
are feeding
so much
the prison system. Yes.
I can't hear you.
And it's a lot of discrimination.
Yes, ma'am. It's a whole lot of discrimination. Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
It is. It's what I call the new slavery. But my mother says that's segregation. But they're only making like $2 an hour, you know, when they, you know, work and stuff. And it's like they, over in Alabama, I saw on TV that phone because I can get those Alabama news here. They said that the people were protesting who worked at a certain factory because they were giving the jobs to the people in the prison.
Right, because that's a new way of getting materials made for as less money as possible. Yes. When they got away from real slavery, they got other ways of being a slavery, and these things were called sharecroppers and home workers that they paid $3 a day, and it was a lot of things that they did. People, men and women, were only making $3 a day as a way of earning a living. And at that time, they didn't even have social services. So that meant people had to work really hard in order to make a living.
Yes, $3 a day. And what makes it so bad, some black people who weren't paid in cash had to pay taxes doing segregation. Did you know that in college?
Yes. People, they had taxes taken out of their monies or whatever money, and no, they didn't get the benefit for it. And another thing, the lifespan of African Americans has been very much shorter than any other group. So with Social Security, they can only benefit when they get to be the ages of 62, 65, and now 67. The lifespan of the average black man was 67 years old. They hardly ever lived to get to the point where they withdraw Social Security.
Yes, because all that was for white people back then, really. At one point, it was mostly for whites. And today, I understand why people say black people shouldn't have to pay taxes, that there should be reparations for blacks. I understand all that.
Yes. Also, that's a whole other story, another book, Angela.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. All right. But I'm for reparations for black people. I don't think it should just go to certain leaders in the black community, like the church. I think it should go to every family, but it's never happened.
It has never happened that I know of.
No, ma'am, that I know of either, reparations hasn't happened, where everybody that can could prove that their parents were slaves, not parents, but their ancestors were slaves, to get reparations for that. As far as I know, that's never happened either. But the young people, you know, I look around in the small town, southern town I'm in, the young people don't seem to care. I feel like they have any choices either.
That's a depressive thought. People get, when you get in repression, and repression is the same thing as, it's more of a segregated thing, but it's also a mental challenge for people. They get depressed. And when you're in a depressive area, you have a depressive attitude, you have depressive and negativity all around you, and you don't feel as though you're going to be able to do for yourselves. And you're waiting for someone to hand you something a lot of times, or someone to do for you. And this is because people are not encouraged to do for themselves. They're not given the opportunity to do for themselves. Let me just go back to March Memories for you.
Okay. All right.
March Memories was my acknowledgement of the things that we had to do on a daily basis that we looked forward to. The kind of things that we knew we had to put in place. It was a mental challenge. When I talked about mental, I thought about how much mental strategy, how much mental strength and energy we had to put out in order to be able to make that plan that was so successful. And that's the real background or backbone of March Memories. It's a short book, but it tells about the challenges that we put on ourselves to enact the kind of cruelty that we knew we would be have put on us when we were walking into the library or doing some type of activity, such as a read-in or a sit-in. And we practice being hit, being called names, being mentally challenged with the negativity that we knew was a part of breaking a person down and breaking their personality or their attitudes down. And this was so important
Mr.
that
Everett,
we
Mr.
go through
Mr.
that.
Mr. Everett, had you do that? Had y'all to practice like that?
I wouldn't say that Mr. Evers had us to practice like that. This was just a part of the plan that we had. This is what we did. This was a part of the nonviolent regiment. And this was set down not by Megar Evers, but it was set down by those who projected what needed to be done in nonviolence. Because if you were not already geared up to understand what people were trying to do, they were trying to make you act or react to what they were doing. And that was the biggest thing. They wanted you to respond so that they could be violent. And when we were nonviolent, that made them even more enraged.
Yes, I understand. Okay. Ever meet Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on this Rosa Parks?
I was in the presence of Dr. Martin Luther King. Those times were just so large until it was hard to say that I just went up to him and talked with him. But I was in his presence.
Yes, ma'am. They killed, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Magna Evers, Dr. Martin Luther King, and Mr. Malcolm X. They were murdered.
They did. Yes, they were all assassinated.
Yes, ma'am, assassinated. Excuse me for that.
Yes.
What did you think during that time period? Were you still in Mississippi, or had you left to go to another state or graduated from the college? I mean,
during the time of Dr. King's assassination, I was in California. I was also in California for Megar Evers' death. And I'm not sure where I was doing Malcolm X, but each one of them was very devastating to me. When you work with someone or when you work towards something that you know is something that is so important as getting your own civil rights, those rights that are have been stated to be a part of what you are in the Constitution, and you have it so deliberately taken from you. When your life is taken from you, that's the most freedom that you have taken away from you. So no matter whatever else you're fighting for, just to live, when someone takes your life, that's the ultimate degree of losing your right to live, your right to exist as a human being.
Okay. What is the Sovereign Committee? You talked about it a little earlier.
Yes, that was a group that was paid by the state of Mississippi, and they consisted of lawyers, officials, and everyday people, business people, who were chosen to really just look into the lives of Black people, not just those who were in the civil rights movement, but everyday people who were some of the leaders in the communities, to find out
yes.
what they were doing, to spy on them. And a lot of times they spied on them through other blacks, and they kept a record. They kept photographs. It was just like stalking in some ways. They kept an eye on people, and they paid people to do things and say things and to tell on people. And many things that was planned to make things better for the black people, they would intervene, and they would be there waiting to put a stop to it or to put a monkey wrench in the plan in some way to make sure that that plan did not go through. Many individuals found themselves listed on these lists that they kept of people, especially in the community where you had ministers and doctors, black doctors and lawyers and principals of schools and people in the public.
Didn't they
yes,
consider
that's
these
what they
people?
Did.
What is the people, black people, weren't they considered communists by some people back then? Because I was reading something about the Act of 1950, which had to do something with, I believe, McCarthy.
Yes, you did have that going on also. Yes. Anybody that worked for the freedom of the black people or the black cause were put on a list because they didn't want people to help. They didn't want people to be active in helping people to do what they wanted to do. So that was something that was put into the McCarthy type of a thought. And I do believe that a lot of those people were movie stars and those people in the entertainment also, because they, I would say not they, but people who were in the entertainment business have been some of the ones who were more outspoken to help blacks along the way.
Okay. So a little bit earlier about in the interview, you talked about repressed expecting someone to hand you something. Would you elaborate on that, please, on your feelings
yes.
and opinion?
Yes. There is a time that I noticed when especially with black people, they wouldn't have let you have jobs. They really didn't make it workable for you to have a husband. If you had a husband and they couldn't really take care of you, they would tell you, well, you can't collect any of these funds if you have this man around.
Okay.
They made it really hard for a lot of young people to do things, and they made it hard for the young men to even have a job because they would take away the jobs. Remember when I talked about earlier how they would do social promotion? I watched a lot of young people who finished high school, supposedly should have graduated, but they didn't have the skills or the knowledge to really go on to school, and they didn't have the skills and training to do those kinds of jobs that people learned when they were taking woodshop and electrical work in the workshops in school. I think mechanical training. They had taken a lot of those things out of the schools. So they really didn't give people, they didn't give people the tools to be self-sufficient.
Okay.
So as a result, people couldn't work and hold jobs that would support their families.
Okay. So in this time period, 2014, you said that you feel like, and in your opinion, that the younger generation has lost their pride. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Well, when you don't know where you come from and you don't know the pride and the joy, even though we were under segregation, And even though we were segregated, even though we had second-class citizenship, there was pride in the black communities. People felt good about themselves when they could work, when they could have their families and feed their families. It wasn't about the materialistic things. It was more about having a good family, being able to support your children and give them the things that they needed. And now people are just looking for a handout because they have been programmed to think, gimme, gimme, gimme. And that's, I think that is one of the reasons why people right now, I know that there are things that they want, but they are more concerned about the things that they want than the things that they need. And they will go out, and if they get money, it's a lot of time, they will buy the things that they want, and they will expect someone to give or support them on the things that they need. Because they've lost that self-pride. It's about the materialistic things now, more so than having pride. And I'm seeing that so much with the younger people now. You know, they have to wear a certain brand of shoes. No matter what the parents are doing to try to keep the family together, they have been so programmed that they cannot have any self-esteem if they're not wearing certain brands. It's not about how the family is living together, how they're taking care of each other or supporting each other. So that makes a lot of difference in families. And I call that, I think I did call that being repressed or depressed or having a lack of pride for themselves.
I understand what you're saying. So, Ms. Geraldine Hollins, I'm going to go to break, a quick break. I've got to talk about some commercials, not commercials, but some people's businesses and things. And I'll come back to you in about 5 minutes, okay?
Are we off the air or recording?
No,
now?
Ma'am. No, ma'am, we're not off the air. I'm just going to talk about some commercials, then I'm going to come back and finish the interview with you, if that's okay with you.
Okay, I'm in a parking lot, and I know that there were some other sounds coming in, and I was hoping that I couldn't be, that
okay.
I wouldn't be in this area.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll go ahead and finish this up to accommodate you. So the interview is just about coming to an end. Where can the listeners go and purchase your books? Your books?
The books are online. Both books can be ordered at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. There is a website, www.backtomississippi.com. And the books can be ordered at most bookstores. It is supposed to be in Barnes & Noble, but it just depends on the request for the book. We are trying to get more of the bookstores in this area to carry the books and some of the local bookstores in other areas to carry the books. However, if people are interested, I really hope that they will ask for the book. And if they don't carry it in that particular store, perhaps they can start carrying the book.
So your books are March, Memories, and Back to Mississippi. Is there any other books?
Those are the only two that I get credit for, but we did do as a collaboration The Daughters and Spirit of Harriet, which was a collaborative adventure, and all of the donations from this book will go to the Oakland Children's Hospital in Oakland, California.
Okay. All right. So, I thank you for coming on the show. I mean, it's really been a pleasure to have, and I apologize for different things. It couldn't be helped. I hope you accept my apologies, but I'm so glad you came on Show Talk with Angela Butler. I don't get to hear about too many women who played such a large part
in the civil rights era and the change of things, changing things. So it was wonderful hearing you and listening to you. I really enjoyed being on the show, and I'd like for you to come back one day.
Well, I would love that, Angela. I really hope that you would get me back sometime and give me a little bit of a head up in some of the things that you want to talk about so that we can really have them out there and ready to move with.
Okay, I just got a couple of questions through chat. I know you want to get off the phone, but I have this chat line in this studio, online studio, and they want to know about, they're asking about the Sovereign Committee. They want to know, was that considered the Ku Klux Klan, or was that the FBI?
It was not considered the Ku Klux Klan, per se, but I'm sure many of the people probably were a part of the Ku Klux Klan. The Sovereignty Commission is just now really opening up so that people can see. We knew that there was a Sovereignty Commission back in the 60s, but now they're really opening up and they have documentation of the type of people, the people who were a part of this group.
Okay.
And so that's what's being revealed now. And if people will go online and just go to Sovereign Tree Commission, they will see specifically some of the things that was done and even some of the people who were spearheading some of these things.
Okay. All right. So do you ever go back to Mississippi to visit? Do you mostly?
Oh, yes. Yes, every year, I have family there, and I see the results of a lot of things there. In fact, in Mississippi, we have more elected black officers, we have more businesses, and things like that than you have in some of our bigger cities and places in California, as per population. And the people are getting along very well. In fact, I was just in Mississippi for the Freedom 50, and I would love to talk to you maybe at another time about my tour. I took 4 weeks that I toured in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas, and I spoke to various groups, and all of them were very receptive. And my audiences were not just black people. I had various groups of whites as well.
That is wonderful. That is wonderful. I'm glad Mississippi has changed because I normally only go there once a year for family reunions and when they come here. But I'm so glad to hear that. All right. So I just got one more question. This is my own question. What do you think of First Lady Michelle Obama?
Wonderful model. Wonderful model. And we are all blessed to, in our lifetime, to have been able to see a black person and first lady, and a first lady who represents a lady to be a part of this administration. And the things that she worked for are things that should help everyone. And when we look out at her legacy, we can say that she made inroads as well as our president, Barack Obama.
Yes. Yes, she has. All right, thank you. Thank you, Miss Geraldine. Edward Howard, thank you for coming on Show Talk with Angela Butler. I hope to have you back one day when it's convenient for you.
Well, thank you.
I'll look forward
to that. Thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am. And if you want to come on again, just call me.
Okay.
Thank you, Miss Howard.
All right, thank you so much. Okay.
Yes, ma'am. All right, everyone, you're listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. The guest has been Miss Geraldine Edward Hollis. She's the author of March Memories and Back to Mississippi. She was talking about the Tougaloo 9. I hope I pronounced that right. Not often, that we get to hear about the ladies and what they did. You know, we all know about Miss Coretta Scott King, Miss Rosa Parks, and maybe two or three more, a couple of more, but we... You know, I personally don't get to hear about the role black women played in the civil rights era, And now that I know about her, I'm very pleased. It makes me proud to know that. James Meredith is my cousin. I don't think he knows it, though, but he is. And anyway, this has been kind of an emotional moment. But I'm going to go into the commercials and to listen to this interview and purchase some books. If you don't purchase it for yourself, then purchase it for your young people, your children, or your grandchildren, or your adopted children. All right, now I'm going to go into the commercials. Do not forget the Acceptable Victim book. It can be by Barry Hanna. It can be found on Amazon.com. Also, The Right Foundation. The Right Foundation is a foundation that is giving people a hand up, not a handout. For those of you who want to be faith partners, you can go to www.righthfoundation.com. I'm a writer for Urban Spice magazine out of Georgia. For those of you who want a year subscription, you can get one, I believe, for $14.99 a whole year. And next at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, no, 8 o'clock Central Standard Time, I held back on the show. Tamara Cray Fraser and Coach Faye Baker. The name of their book is In His Own Time. Also, The Love I Never Had by James Wallace McDonald. He's also from Mississippi. He's also an inventor and a writer. And I like for you to remember the R&B soul singer Tawana Leal. Her song Crazy, Crazy in Love can be found on YouTube.com, Reverber Nation, iTunes, and some of everywhere. So don't forget to cater to these people's businesses and their books and their songs. Let's support each other. Also, again, I'd like to say thank you. Thank you to Miss Geraldine Hollis Edwards. She definitely told a lot and enlightened everyone. And she's right about the history part. Even I, at 44, can learn a lot more. So her book, I believe, is, hold on. The other book is not only Back to Mississippi, but it is, oh my goodness, don't forget March Memories. Okay, March Memories and Back to Mississippi. These are great books. She didn't say where she'd be doing the next book signing, but she told you where you can go out and find the book. She said at Barnes & Noble, she believed it has to be requested. But do that, request the book and go to her website. I believe she has a website. Her name is Geraldine Edwards Hollis, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, Geraldine Edwards Hollis. So Google her and purchase her book, March Memories, and Back to Mississippi. All right, listeners, you've been listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. I thank you all for tuning in. That's going to be it for tonight. Everybody have a blessed night. Listeners, you've been listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. It's one more thing I'd like to say. We have Miss Tamara Fraser and Coach Faye Baker. They'll be on Show Talk with Angela Butler at 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
For those of you who want to hear the interview, just call in to 1-347-327-9376 and listen to the interview, or you can listen to it in the archive. The name of the show, of course, is Show Talk with Angela Butler. So 8 o'clock Central Standard Time tonight, 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, we will have Tamara, Pray Fraser, and Coach Faye Baker on Show Talk with Angela Butler. They'll be talking about inspirational books in his own time. Of course, his means God. Everyone have a good night.